Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls, weekly two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We are seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 123. It's our new arc, Jesus of Nazareth. Strap on your sandals and join us as we return to Galilee and surrounding lands. We've been away for a few months, but it's always a fine thing to return back to Jesus. In this case, his earliest life up through his young adulthood. We'll be spending the next several months exploring whatever we can and trying to bring these passages, these papers to life for all of us, bring them into our own lives. And from the book of Proverbs, start off a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22. A little food for thought up front. I'm sure there were people of that time who could read something like that and make sense of it. Hope we can too. I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you've joined us here live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. Tonight, it's a different rotation. We've still got, of course, Dr. Chris Halverson. Then David Tucker is back with us, and Justin Armstrong is here. And, of course, you're here. We're so glad you are. Won't you join us in this study back into Part 4 of the Urantia Papers? Call up the text as you please and take your seat. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. Thanks for that intro. Hope everyone enjoys our new series as we get it rolling here. This first block of papers after Jesus is born, they give you a wonderful summary of the whole development. Not going into all the details of around the Mediterranean, but they give you a great survey of all the development of Jesus of Nazareth. In that pre-public ministry span of his life, definitely illuminating, one of the greatest questions of the last 2,000 years for anyone who's identified with Jesus during these two millennia. What all went on before his public ministry? So it's a very rich resource, a very great blessing to mankind for the midwares to lay this all out, and we'll, like Brad was saying, we'll step our way through it, and as always, seek to awaken the truth that lies between the lines of all the facts of his life, and then not to leave you guys out. Great to have you two in the rotation here for this first series. Hello to you, Dave, and hello to you, Justin, and once again, hello to everyone listening. Enjoy the show.
Yes, thank you for that, Chris. Thanks for kind of teeing it up and setting the general framing for this. It is indeed quite a gift to have restored to us, told to us for the first time, these events of Jesus' childhood, and what a gift it is for us to be able to come together here in virtual internet land and try to make some sense of it. I've certainly read these papers before, but I'll admit this block of papers, sometimes I go a little light on reading them because I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do with them? They're just sort of facts, and it was a long time ago. And I know we can do better, and I know we can bring them to life, and I'm really looking forward to it. And good evening to you, Justin. How are you, sir?
I am well. Good evening, Brad. Good evening, Dr. Chris, and good evening, Dave. I'm very excited to be studying the early childhood of Jesus with everyone tonight. Looking forward to it.
Yes, we're glad that you're here. And Andrea has rotated off of the show here for a little bit for this subsequent series here, and she will certainly be missed, but we're keeping the crew here to four at a time, and in her place here for the next several weeks, we've got David. David, you're back with us. Good evening, sir. And you took it to one step further. Even though you weren't here last week, you wrote us a summary to catch us up on last week. So how are you, and what can you tell us?
Hey, Brad. I'm doing well. Hello, Justin. Hello, Dr. Chris.
And hello, Andrea. I know you're listening. We love you. We miss you. Yeah, it was a great honor to be able to put together some summary of last week's episode. And essentially on the topic that began speaking after the reading was this idea of the foolish notions of chemically induced spiritual experiences. So after reading the previous review, we observed how someone listening to the previous week's show might attempt to divine some secret of contacting spirit by consuming something or doing something to their bodies. In general, when we talk about the fact that our agitant minds are attuned to our biology, one can have a higher agitant mind function because we have a more well-coordinated biologic mechanism. It's a fool's quest to analyze our bodies and figure out how to tweak things by utilizing supplements to give ourselves a biologic uplift because Adam and Eve fell short of that goal. The key point in general is when we're talking about an attunement, it's in the super summative nature of our biology. Our minds are attuned to the unanalyzable nature of our body, gland chemistry, and the like. If you analyze your DNA or the hormones in your body, you come up with all sorts of analytic conclusions. Get tongue-tied there. It's a very linear, down-in-the-plane assessment of all that's possible with current scientific understandings. Perhaps in the far distant future, amidst the light and life quality of physics, that will be different. But right now, it's not even remotely possible. Mind energy is absolutely transcendent of physical energy. And at the foundation of those two energies, there is absolutely no interplay between the two. Each of those inner energies have independent absolutes, paradise, source, and center, and the third source and center. And they're absolutely separate absolutes. If there's going to be a so-called attunement of mind and biology, it must be in some very transcendent, rarefied conceptual space where transcendent of the two absolutes that divide the two energies has some super absolute interplay between the two. In other words, a bit too far out of our pay grade, ladies and gents. No amount of fuzzing out will get you anywhere fast unless your aim is to end up with dementia at a far younger age than your genetics and your environment would naturally dictate. It's very important to be humbly respectful of what we have, wittingly or otherwise, purely by the grace of God alone. The vicissitudes of the rebellion and default could have taken us so far out of whack that we could have very well lost the ability to have consciousness, but we didn't. We don't have the slightest clue of why we're conscious, let alone the ability to somehow construct a makeshift biologic erector set to possibly improve on that. You could end up erecting something out of the realm of ascension. It's best to stick with what we got and play in the tadpole games where it's safe. The master sought out the limited equilibrium he could find and leveraged off of it. He made sure he did not disrupt those phases of stability that were there despite all the issues of this world. And he leveraged that faint flicker of quality mind upward. He wasn't limited by all the pits of unascending ability in his biology. There is no shortage of aspects of our biology that are deeply unascendable. The master ascended despite those aspects, and you can also. It's insidious to believe that any of us could formulate or even discover a material secret formula to chemically induce a spiritual or divine experience. Paper 49, The Inhabited World, in Section 6, The Terrestrial Escape. It's easy to get excited about the messenger hosts of space reference here, but careful to recognize that the divine executioners are one of them. On one hand, the Lord giveth, represented by the thought adjusters, and the other, the Lord taketh away, represented by the divine executioners. It's a subtle reminder that the gift of the divine thought adjusters is a double-edged sword. Each of us has a very tenuous and primitive starting point in our ascension in terms of any of us being able to get off of the rock we were born on. The unfortunate combination of current UB readers' thoughts and Jewish fantasies from 2,000 years ago leads to the unfortunate humanistic speculation, more akin to pleasing fables. Desire to be special because we read this book reminds this reviewer of the apostles fighting for the seat on the right or the left of the master at the dinner table. Of course, the same wisdom applies of finding the humility to sit at the lowest seat. Assume you're at the bottom rung, and if perchance you did more than merely misinterpret everything you've read in the Revelation and were grown into more than an iota of humility, you may get pulled up further in the seat order. This reviewer assumes he won't even have a seat at the table and instead is busying himself with bothering the waitress for a child seat with strap-in restraints and something to color while waiting on the food. Salvation is on God's terms, not ours. Important detail to remember is that from the time of the rebellion until 2,000 years ago at Pentecost, nobody on this planet could ascend individually. Regardless of circle attainment, you were stuck until the dispensation age. The revelators are hitting us with the Bible's greatest hits from Daniel and Matthew 24, lest we attempt to put on the big boy pants a little prematurely. Just a spoonful of humility helps this medicine go down. In the eyes of the universe, the arrival of the adjuster constitutes identity. Personality is a spirit-substance pattern, and our minds are not spirit-substance. The adjuster is the spirit-substance to us, not the personality management or spirit ministries. It's a literal object, stuff. Our personality is not influencing our direct mindful self at this point. That's seated on our soul, it's influencing our agitate minds. There's a direct reference when speaking directly about the different types of planetary resurrections, and we have a very different type of human that gets resurrected in each dispensation. Primitive humans, those that are post-arrival of the planetary prince, don't have a mind that can fuse with the thought adjuster. It's a fascinating unpacking of the different types of humans for the different dispensations, and it's worthy everyone's efforts to visit the archives and have another listen of last week's show and the wrap-up of our previous arc. And this ends our summary.
All right, David, thank you so much for taking the time to put that together. That was humorous, entertaining, but also informative, as your reviews are often want to be. That certainly ups the game with what did we have? We had a pop culture reference. Okay, yeah, Mary Poppins. That's a new one. We're digging into the Disney archives. I like it.
Well done, Dave.
And yeah,
thanks, guys.
You know, it's just been on my mind a lot. It's directly in the Urantia book, and it's a whole section title. And Christian preachers have been talking about it for centuries, maybe not as popularly in these last 100 years, but salvation is on God's terms, not ours. That just really was sitting in my mind, maybe on my heart in the last week, thinking about my own life, but also just thinking about so many Urantia book readers, or if you're out on social platforms, you can see people often introduce themselves like, well, what I believe is this, you know, I believe we are from the stars, and I believe that, and there's just a long list of things that they believe. And it's like, well, that's fancy. That's clever, you know, but are those God's terms of salvation? Classic Christian preaching says it's not up for you to decide. Again, a classic Christian preaching would say it's in the Bible, in God's word. You know, they would be very literal about where to find those terms of salvation. But that message hasn't changed with the advent of the Urantia book here on our world. Salvation is still on God's terms. It's really been on my mind, including some very self-centered notions that I held earlier times in my life, and I hope I've expunged them mostly from my own life, but it remains to be seen.
Yeah, not to kick off another lengthy discussion of this topic that we've had so many times, but one other little very interesting sentence from our vast tome of Revelation, that directly speaks to this this tendency, as you're talking about, of in modern times, so-called modern times, to have somehow gotten it in our heads, you know, even if you're a person that doesn't reject, you know, God or an afterlife or anything like that, but nonetheless, there's been this tendency to think that if you're just, a person that conforms to the current approved social standards, that gives you God's favor and you can just take your salvation for granted and do whatever. Fuss around with, factual details in the Arantia book or what have you. But if you go to paper 28, section 6, paragraph 9, single column, page 315, there's a number of interesting tidbits that you can find in some of these places in the Revelation. It's like, there's all that stuff about tertiary seconophim, It's like, okay, wow, that's like way down in the weeds, I'll skip that. Let me read about Jesus again. But if you look there's one of those that are called the import of time. And let's read the first part of that first paragraph there of 28:6-9. Time is the one universal endowment of all will creatures. It is the one talent entrusted to all intelligent beings. So notice how they start, as I was kind of joking there, I think I'll go read Jesus again. Well, there's that parable about the talents. And how harsh that parable is.
Right.
If you don't do anything with that one talent, even what you have is taken from you. So they're wanting you to have that stark fact in your mind before you read the next sentence. What does it say? You all have time in which to ensure your survival. And time is fatally squandered only when it is buried in neglect, when you fail so to utilize it as to make certain the survival of your soul. So, there's all kinds of things you can do at time. Right? You can do all kinds of things in the name of the Lord with your time.
Right.
You can study the Arantia book with your time. Okay? But are those the terms of salvation? Are you fatally squandering? And as a very nice person, as a person who is conforming with all the approved social standards of the most enlightened people of the day, but nonetheless, did you make certain the survival of your soul? Well, certainly if you're just saying, I'm a nice person, so I can take my salvation for granted, just like the Revelation says. Well, it also says this. So maybe that's not exactly what it says about taking your salvation for granted. Maybe I need to go back and think about the proper interpretation of that sentence.
Yeah. I have to ensure my survival? What, there's something I'm having to do here? I don't know. Whoa. Goodness.
Yeah. There's nothing automatic about it. That's the Lucifer manifesto. The moment that you're thinking that, you've at least to that degree joined the rebellion to think that you don't have to ensure your survival. And hence you fatally squander your one talent. Right? And so even that little embryonic soul that you were given is taken from you. Right? The moral of the parable.
Right, of course.
You didn't invest the one talent. So, as you were saying, Brad, there is nothing more fundamental to any genuine religious thought throughout the last million years, the million years of human history. Right? That can't be changed by an epical revelation. It is just a fact that we are a far cry from a Havana native.
Right. Well, as I mentioned a while back, I think there are a lot of your Urantia book readers who have confused a timeless truth about, you know, the need for salvation, the terms of salvation. You know, they get to paper 4, section 5, paragraph 6, 4, 5, 6. Easy to remember. And it's the first time that one of the revelators takes the atonement doctrine out behind the woodshed and has its moment with it. And again, like I say, people just kind of stop reading there. They say, okay, well, that's it. There are no terms of salvation because they've thrown out the atonement doctrine. They've called it a travesty. It's like, no, you've conflated two things. You've conflated a doctrine with an eternal truth. They're not the same thing. They're trying to clear up the water and get rid of some outdated, you know, superstitious doctrine, hoping that you can let go of that, but grab hold of, not let go of the truth and grab hold of some greater doctrine, if you will, something greater. But they have not thrown out the terms of salvation in 4, 5, 6.
Yeah, see, and again, if you think about it, the person really, you know, has an unfortunate false philosophic consistency. You know, they go, oh, yeah, see, right there in 4, 5, 6, the revelators tell you that, that human-conceived terms of salvation is not valid. But my human terms of salvation is valid.
That is an odd thought when you put it that way.
See, really, they haven't gone anywhere, right? See, they misinterpret, you know, that exclamation statement about travesty, because they're fundamentally in this humanistic culture they were born and raised in. You know, that if one of these people still talks about God or considers God, they think of it on their terms and not his. It's very difficult to escape being indoctrinated in a humanistic worldview.
But Chris, there's no marketing scheme for gods. I mean, I just got sold a Netflix subscription.
it should sell itself. You know, the promise of eternal life, even the animal craving for self-preservation is a pointer toward, you know, something in us that knows that there can be something beyond just this life. It should sell itself, but it is a free gift given out, but you do have to choose it. And then once you're in the kingdom, you are expected to bear much fruit.
Yeah. So, yeah. It doesn't hurt, you know, every time it comes up to just, further consider, how firmly the revelation maintains the truth of all time about salvation, so that when you consider that which is quite new in the revelation, you maintain those new elements on the fundamental foundation of religion. Salvation, rather than taking those new elements and putting them on your own foundation that's bound to time instead of eternity, to incorporate the newness of the revelation into your humanistic concept frame, which is devoid of survival values, God-knowingness, and God-ascension.
The humanistic concept frame is why the revelation is here, as we are very fond of saying. Incorporating the revelation into it, yes, revelation always gets incorporated into some evolutionary religious mainstream, but humanism is not a true religious mainstream. You can't blend it with that. It won't. It It won't work in eternity. It may give you some false illusions of success for a time, but you're fooling yourself.
I mean, you know, you think that the paragraph 456 travesty sentence deserves an exclamation point? I mean, what kind of a travesty is it to put the fifth epical revelation into a humanistic concept frame?
That's a far worse humanistic, human-based scheme for the terms of salvation than the atonement doctrine. At least the atonement doctrine was an evolution of a...
Many people who fervently believed the atonement doctrine made it to the first mansion world and still do.
Faith,
well, they had faith, right? They had faith, and salvation is to always be had in relationship to faith.
Right. You know, it, theology is irrelevant, right, when all is said and done. Atonement doctrine is theology. Was the person religious or not? You know, and divesting yourself, ever more self-righteously of the atonement doctrine is not meeting the terms of salvation.
Hmm.
You know,
right.
That's the Pharisee in another one of the classic parables. Boy, am I glad I'm not like that guy, that Christian over there that believes the atonement doctrine.
Yeah.
You're the Pharisee. And you don't have God's favor when you think like that. You don't get mercy, you get justice.
Well, I know, like you say, we obviously bring this up often because, of course, we're trying to get through to people who need to hear this. Myself, 15 years ago, needed to hear this. And maybe sometimes I still need to hear this. There's a reason that Christians, ever since the advent of the moving type printing press, have done their, you know, really devout Christians have read their Bible regularly. You have to kind of remind your animal origin self. Otherwise, it'll just drift, particularly if the material currents are what they are in days like these. So I don't mind that we bring this up, but we do bring it up often. I'm glad that we had this conversation.
And again, it's also one other thing. It's also important, I think, to take this concept of the atonement doctrine in the fullness of human history and recognize that even at the times of Melchizedek, people were moving back to sacrifices and the shedding of blood in preferring that in relationship to the atonement doctrine. So it's not something that just was relating to the crucifixion. This is something that goes way, way back. It's a natural sort of part of the human condition to seek favor with God through works, not through faith. It's entrenched in early man.
And even if it isn't works righteousness, just a basic sin sacrifice and atonement modality.
Yeah.
Again, just it's so important to just challenge yourself. You know, to not have all these blind spots of humanistic framing, it serves you very poorly.
Yeah, I loved Moses.
That import of time sentence. I mean, to sum it up, it's saying, anything that you can think of doing with your time, when all is said and done, is six of one, half a dozen of another. Except for one thing.
Mm.
There's only one thing that's really important, says the import of time. Only one thing. Not everything else is six of one, half a dozen another. So, again, what did Jesus say? Seek first the kingdom of heaven. There's one thing and one thing only that's key. That you must do. Everything else is whatever. But there's one thing you must do. Right? And you know you're not, you haven't done that if you've lived a life believing that that's automatic and there's nothing that you have to do.
Yeah. Yep. Well, welcome to Symmetry of Soul, where we tell people something that's not popular amongst your Rancho Book readers, but it's an old truth. And it's taken a while to get it through this old chunk of Cole's thick skull. I don't know. Everyone, longtime listeners, probably watched me go through this evolutionary process, like going, wait a minute. Wait, there are terms of salvation. Like, yeah, I did that on the air here. So, and if I can do it, oh, Lord, you can too.
Yeah, and this isn't as, you know, as tangential. I mean, as we start to read the early childhood of Jesus, one of the most important things about his early childhood is that he had a religious upbringing.
Yes.
Not just a nice one, a religious one, and that all kinds of, you know, if you drop back to the beginning of the paper before this about the birth and infancy, you know, they remind you that, you know, great effort was made to make sure that that was the case. You know, it's not just a genetic filter, right, that they sifted everything through to select Mary and Joseph. It was whether or not it was certain that they would give Jesus a religious upbringing so that he would survive. Because it would be just really problematic if the incarnate creator son went to iniquity.
That would be a new one. Yeah.
Fairly significant upheaval of the universe of universes.
Yeah.
Because, again, he's not a
yes.
fetish man. We're not going to be reading about the early childhood of a fetish man. You know, and some of the, you know, as I was saying at the beginning, you know, because you don't really have any of this story that we're about to start studying in the New Testament, you know, people... You know, in near New Testament times, you know, made up stories to fill in the blanks. You know, and those stories are the stories of what was it like, you know, for Jesus the fetish man when he was a kid? How many magic tricks did he, you know, do? You know, did he resurrect dead birds?
Is that one of the Apocrypha? I'm wondering if you're referring to something like, I know there are a lot of those stories floating around.
All kinds of New Testament Apocrypha, yes.
Right.
You know, not the,
of course.
You know, not the, the Old Testament Apocrypha, but the New Testament Apocrypha.
Right.
Stories, you know, so not stories that are spin-offs from the Old Testament, but stories that are spin-offs from the New Testament.
Right.
And, right, and so, you know, that's another aspect of what we're about to read. You know, this is a human boy, the product of a biologic mother and a biologic father. And, you know, nothing magical about him, just a boy that can skin his knee like any other boy. And so because of that, as we study this, boy, you know, all the way to manhood named Jesus of Nazareth, it has relevancy. I mean, a fairy tale about a magic person has no relevancy to our lives.
Right.
Everything about this is, I mean, you know, unlike the public ministry where you have to, it's like, well, okay, that's not really directly applicable. That's totally, you know, son of God stuff there and whatnot. You know, not to mention master son level stuff, you know, as opposed to just merely creator son. Yeah, but this is just Jesus the man starting as a babe. Right? And so it's all completely relevant. The more you study, the more you understand, you know, because of the way the midwives are going to tell the story, it illuminates the truth of a human life.
Right. a human life in the context of a religious culture and in a religious household. I can go read Huckleberry Finn if I want a story about a boy, but this is a helpful story about a boy.
Yeah. You know, like I said, what it really is, how our lives are potentialized and actualized relative to eternity.
Right.
Not just how they roll out in time.
You know, that that reminds me of the statement in 118:1, where they say, begins to view the landscape of time from the panoramic perspective of broadened horizons, begins perhaps to suspect the non-beginning, non-ending, eternal continuum, the fragments of which are called time. And in one of the key words for today's study was this adjuster arrival. And one thing I wanted to share for tonight's study is I was thinking about kind of the perspective of an adjuster, and I was imagining the challenge of a thought adjuster looking down upon your material body and conscious mind from a super conscious perspective. And from the adjuster's vantage point, it's like, well, that body is going to be dust soon, and that mind will be unplugged soon. And then I was imagining your personality potentially fusing with that thought adjuster by having the same intensity of directional focus on the eternal in contrast to the temporal. And this is the personality that's consecrated to the perfect will of the Father. Its focus point is, as Chris just stated, rooted in the eternal. And that's why they're able to fuse together.
You can't strike step with a thought adjuster whose feet are inescapably in eternity unless your feet are in eternity.
Yes.
Yeah. So no amount of fancy, dance moves, with your feet in time gets you anything. Yeah. Again, it gets back to that whole issue of what one must do to be saved. And this never-ending desire to think that the terms of salvation have to do with some sort of doings with your feet and hands in time. And it can't. I mean, especially, once you know that what you're attempting to do to secure that is fused as a thought adjuster, and the thought adjuster is, has a literal existential core. Talk about feet that are, firmly planted in eternity and can't be anything else. There's all kinds of song and dance that you can do in the name of Jesus, God, the Lord. Right? But that doesn't get you to strike step with a fact that has feet in eternity. Right? And so as you're looking at Jesus, growing up, you're seeing him transition from something, that inescapably is just all about time, to something that transcends that. And how did he do it? How did Jesus survive? Did he do it totally on his own? Was it all just grace and he didn't have to do anything? Were his parents very important? Was his neighborhood environment very important? How does this work? How does a lumpen blob of clay survive?
Yeah. Well, let's start finding out. I suggest we commence with the reading. So, folks, we are in paper 123 of the Urantia Papers. That's titled The Early Childhood of Jesus. So just for reference, we have previously on Symmetry of Soul covered paper 122. That's the birth and infancy of Jesus. I think we covered that around Christmas time here and there for notable reasons. And we covered the times of Michael's bestowal previously as well. So we're starting here. We've never really covered this paper before, but we've got a child here. Like, by the time we're done this evening, Jesus is able to locomote around on his own and have some thoughts of his own. And so let's see what we've got here. It's paper 1355.
It just occurred to me before you read. I mean, you know, you teed up a, you know, for those who love numbers. So we're reading paper 1, 2, 3. And what was the numbers of the paragraph you had us go back to? Okay, so we're all over it tonight.
And those are also names of midwayers. Oh, we've got it all covered. Okay.
Yes, blob of clay, 1, 2, 3, the third.
What does it all mean? All right, folks, it's on page 1355 if you're in some sort of printed edition of the book. Otherwise, call it up on a screen somewhere. Owing to the uncertainties and anxieties of their sojourn in Bethlehem, Mary did not wean the babe until they had arrived safely in Alexandria, where the family was able to settle down to a normal life. They lived with kinsfolk, and Joseph was well able to support his family as he secured work shortly after their arrival. He was employed as a carpenter for several months and then elevated to the position of foreman of a large group of workmen employed on one of the public buildings then in process of construction. This new experience gave him the idea of becoming a contractor and builder after their return to Nazareth.
There's a couple of things there. One immediately there at the end. Again, remember what... You know, what the purpose of all this is. You know, it's not just, oh, let's toss him this factoid. This new experience gave him the idea of becoming a contractor and builder after their return to Nazareth. It's like, you know, the father is going to be able to supply a relative stable family setting for Jesus once they get back to Nazareth, and you know, doing it here as well. If Mary and Joseph's lives in practical terms were in utter chaos, Jesus maybe wouldn't have survived.
Well, look at how they describe Joseph was well able to support his family. They're emphasizing what you're touching on.
Right. Yeah, see, so, you know, just, you know, we won't belabor every sentence like that, okay? But, see, you know, just, you know, if nothing else, you know, consider a thought parallel to that. And, oh, okay, how is this relative to, you know, the fact that Jesus was born and raised in a way that it wasn't, you know, by the slimmest of margins, you know, that he managed to survive. You know, where does the greater stabilizing environment come from? What role do mothers play? What role do fathers play?
Right.
Et cetera. Okay. As Brad was saying, you know, since we're... you know, we skipped a couple of little very beginning details, you know, besides the, you know, the birth. Recall, you know, how this works, that they're in Bethlehem, you know, subsequent to the birth, you know, for, you know, basically a year, you know, a little bit more than a year, actually. And it's in October of 6 B.C. that Herod, you know, decides he just needs to kill all the kids, you know, to try, because he hasn't been able to specifically find Jesus, and so he's just going to kill them all, right? And Joseph and family escaped to Alexandria, right, because they got warned of it. Right, so you had... Yeah, you had basically a year in Bethlehem, and then we go to Alexandria, and we're going to have a couple years in Alexandria. So just, you know, kind of just everyone remember, you know, that that's the, you know, th- those those first 3 years were kind of interesting for Jesus, and that you were, you know, having to, Joseph and Mary were having to dance with the complexities of their day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very, very true. Yeah. All through these early years of Jesus' helpless infancy, Mary maintained one long and constant vigil lest anything befall her child which might jeopardize his welfare or in any way interfere with his future mission on earth. No mother was ever more devoted to her child. In the home where Jesus chanced to be, there were two other children about his age, and among the near neighbors there were six others whose ages were sufficiently near his own to make them acceptable playfellows. At first, Mary was disposed to keep Jesus close by her side. She feared something might happen to him if he were allowed to play in the garden with the other children. But Joseph, with the assistance of his kinsfolk, was able to convince her that such a course would deprive Jesus of the helpful experience of learning how to adjust himself to children of his own age. And Mary, realizing that such a program of undue sheltering and unusual protection might tend to make him self-conscious and somewhat self-centered, finally gave assent to the plan of permitting the child of promise to grow up just like any other child. And though she was obedient to this decision, she made it her business always to be on watch while the little folks were at play about the house or in the garden. Only an affectionate mother can know the burden that Mary carried in her heart for the safety of her son during these years of his infancy and early childhood.
And when we get in here a little bit further, there's a kind of key paragraph where we'll speak to. You know, it seems like they have some sort of specificity going on here with terms. They're talking about infancy and early childhood, like the title of this paper, you know, infancy, you know, not just here, but in the title of the preceding paper. You know, we'll sort that out. But, you know, but for the moment, you know, notice the helpless part, okay, in that first sentence, helpless infancy. And that, you know, then, you know, we all know that because we are a very advanced mammal. You know, our children start out in a very helpless state. You know, they don't just pop out of mom and start running and feeding themselves.
Right.
So that's a key point. And notice right in the middle of that paragraph, what did they say? It would deprive Jesus of the helpful experience. So when you have a helpless infant, you know, there's need for all kinds of helpful influences. You know, there's nothing but, has to be helpful. I mean, it's just, it's the child is a complete blank slate.
Sure.
They need help with everything. And so, you know, just that general recognition that to begin with, you know, everything parents and others are doing with a child, you know, has to be with that in mind, that you're helping someone completely helpless.
If you're not doing that, and Mary did realize that was the path to go down, but notice that the two descriptions they give, if she were to instead go down the path of undue sheltering and unusual protection, the two descriptions they give are self-conscious and somewhat self-centered, and that reminds me of this twofold pattern of instead of self-centered, you want to focus on God centered, and when you think of self-consciousness, you want to think of consecrating your mind to the harmony of the cosmos. So you're almost seeing that twofold pattern going in the wrong direction due to the lack of helpfulness that Mary could have moved in that direction, but she didn't.
Right. I mean, you know, there needs to be a centering, there needs to be a consciousness, but it it needs to be encouraged to take the initial totally self-absorbed setting of an infant and mature it, you know, to not over-perpetuate the actuality or the fact, let me say it this way, you know, the fact of those starting points, but there's a truth to them. Like you're saying, eventually, you know, you can be God-centered. So you, in the process of not, you know, ending up with an, you know, egotistical individual, you know, if you destroy their ability to center, you know, it's like, well, okay, so now they can't be self-centered, but they can't be centered on God either. So you can't destroy the essence in the process of trying to mature the substance. You saw another thing there, you know, about a third of the way in, about acceptable playfellows. Child needs playfellows. And there has to be thoughts about acceptable, unacceptable.
And particularly because they're in a place like Alexandria. That's not the same as a highly religious culture, you know, in a town in Galilee. I'm sure that they had to keep their eyes open about who Jesus associated with there.
Yeah, I mean, they're in an immediate environment of, you know, of Joseph's relatives, yes. Right? But like you said, I mean, we're talking Alexandria here. This is, you know, this is a big deal metropolis back in those days.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Right there on the vigorous Mediterranean. All kinds of salty dogs about. right. I mean, you know, just... Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, they're always talking in this, you know, richness of, you know, getting you to reflect on, there's yet another thing that was in place so that Jesus wasn't hindered and maybe ultimately thwarted in his attempts to become someone that survives.
Right.
You know, how can you foster a child, you know, to... You know, as best you can to, to not, you know, completely limit their potential that, you know, to actualize into something that survives.
Just before we move on, the one other comment I wanted to make, I wonder, you know, we see... It seems pretty clear that Joseph and Mary had a healthy marriage. It was of its age. It would probably not resemble a healthy marriage of today, even the most ideal one. It was a product of its time. But I'm wondering, and I like how even-handed the midwayers are dealing with Mary. Like they'll say, well, you know, she was being overprotective. But no one can understand this except a mother. Like they always try to be fair to where she was at as a human being. Anyway, my actual point here is I'm wondering if it was Joseph who essentially tempered or overruled her, Like, is this the father family showing the value of the father family over the mother family? If it had been the mother-dominated family, would this have played out very differently? Would he have been over-sheltered?
Yeah, I didn't kind of already tee this up because I'm kind of curious to see if someone would, and you just did. Right? I mean, there's another very key element that's playing out there. You know, besides... You know, the immediacy of, yes, the classic helpless infant plus mother love. Okay, yeah.
Sure.
Right, you've got, yeah, you know, she is indeed an advanced mammal, Mary is, you know, with loads of mother love. Okay, that she just can, you know, is almost impossible to turn off. Okay. You know, but notice, you know, in the setting of it playing out, you know, what you're pointing to, Brad, you're seeing the fundamental differential, you know, and the hence need for complementary pairing between a female and male. Right? Mary is manifesting, you know, not just mother love, but see, what's the basic philosophic quality of her consciousness? It's place-like.
Place-like, yeah.
Right? And it is directionlike.
And notice also the strategy specifically that was taken by Joseph when they describe with the assistance of his kinsfolk. So the ability for him to utilize more voices than his own picture to clearly show the merit.
Yes, and of course we're talking about an art form here. It's not like males are born with, you know, advanced wisdom about how to coordinate their directional instinct with place-like instinct. So Joseph is just getting started with this process, but it isn't his first rodeo. They've been married for a little while here, as they're telling the story right here. Not to mention Joseph was brought up well. He's starting from scratch when he met Mary. To your point, right? I mean, the father family, right? It has nothing to do with, some sort of male bias. It's just the family is this fundamental social unit, and if that society is going to be a progressing society, right, those units of that progressing society have to be directional, fundamentally place-like.
Yeah, exactly.
And so
right. It's
just all important, right, that, there ends up being a collective family unit bias to strike step with the universe of motion, to be moving. To not be overly place-like. You have to supply a place, right? A child needs to be raised in a place, right? And that's part of the challenge here. They're in a little bit of a nomadic time here prior to finally getting back to Nazareth. And so Mary very much needs to, to supply the appropriate place stability, despite that nomadic phenomenon, not totally nomadic, right, but nonetheless, little unsettled. Right? Yeah. But then you can't overplay it, It's like, well, I mean, this is kind of so unsettled. We should really bias on the place-like side. It's like, no, we need to keep moving.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, a static soul is a dying soul. And again, if Jesus, you need to foster a child who can ever more be, a dynamic moving phenomenon. Eventually, right? Your feet have to move so fast that they transcend time and strike step with eternity.
Mm.
Those are fast feet. Right, so if you start a child out, with very heavy mud boots on, are they going to be able to move their feet fast enough to strike step with eternity eventually? No.
Well, Chris, it appears to me that modern-day society has both mothers and fathers that are direction-like. I mean, you talked about highlighting the difference of making sure that there's both a place-like, but there's also movement and direction. But what happens to the family?
What happens if there's no place? It doesn't matter if there's direction. It's pointless, right? You can't direct nothing. Right? You're directing the place. There's no place. Right, it's all just an illusion, the direction, to direct something. So you found it, and then you direct it.
There's this ever-pushing, insidious agenda that, no, all of us are equal. We all have the equal roles and equal distribution of those roles, and and men could be place-like, and women can be direction-like, and it seems to go against, you know, the fundamental lessons that we're being taught here in the Revelation.
If you overplay that, and, you know, there's no difference between men and women, well, then men won't be men, and women won't be women, and God's plan for the survival of his children will fail.
And Revelation helps us recognize this with the ideals of, for instance, Adam and Eve in terms of the family unit as an example. And then you go higher than that and you have Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit as a representation of time and space itself. So it just keeps playing out this pattern. The Revelation gives you that that picture at higher and higher levels.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm speaking so definitively about it. I'm not just, you know, falsely aggrandizing something because it's part of my agenda, you know, some family agenda or something. It's like, no, it's just, it's innate in reality. If mortal children could survive, you know, without the differential between male and female, then male and female wouldn't exist.
Yes.
It
That's
has
part
to
of
be
a larger pattern.
Fundamental
yeah.
to God's plan.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The only way that it couldn't be is if you throw out the idea of there being design in the universe, which won't get you very far in your thinking, not without reaching insanity, but only in a completely random universe could it possibly not matter. The things that are given that are by design, because there's no design. I can't even say the sentence because it's so illogical. Again, you won't get far on that line of thought, but I think there's a lot of people who don't try to pursue these lines of thought very far. Instead, they look for what's expeditious, what's convenient to think, what's maybe less painful to think. It's not easy to think about how males and females are going to have different differential roles and how that's going to create conflict and struggle and strife. Of course it is. That's not easy.
Yeah. So, and you incorporate that with the ever-increasing need for mothers to be working in an environment. I mean, I live in California. To be able to have a family without two incomes is rare now. I mean, both mother and father have to be at work, and it leaves a large missing in this equation that Revelation tells us is necessary.
Yeah, and so perhaps some nomadicness might be needed,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, if the place you find yourself in is fundamentally at odds with raising children that can survive to eternity, then one maybe needs to choose.
That's it. I'm canceling Netflix and packing up. speaking of all this direction likeness, there's four of us here. We got a lot of direction, but we're paused.
But again, I mean, I'm trying to make sure that we don't get overly focused on the direction side. I mean, there's a reason why males and females have the instincts that they do. You know, there's a differential that's hardwired in, you know, by God's designers, because that's indispensable. You can't do it without place. You can't do it without direction. And again, like Brad was pointing out about randomness and whatnot, I mean, you know, there can be, you know, quote unquote arbitrariness in a shallow sense, okay, but not in a deep sense, not in a real sense. Absolutely nothing is arbitrary in a real sense. Right? You know, there's absolutely nothing random when all is said and done about reality. Right? It's mind-planned, mind-mated, and mind-administered. It's mind-made and personality-managed. Period. And it's absolutely designed, not just, you know, relatively designed. It's absolutely designed. Everything is by design when all is said and done. You know, and you know, there's kind of a deep instinctual sense in everyone that that's the case. And so when people rebel against God, see, they rebel against the elements of his design.
Sure. Yeah.
I refuse to accept that, you know, that this is an element of his design. No, this is just some arbitrary thing. Some foreign potentates have imposed upon me. Or the, you know, here and now equivalent of those quote-unquote foreign potentates, right? Some sort of oppressor, you know, has oppressed me thus with this supposed design element. I reject it. So, well, let me see. They're fundamentally rejecting God. You know, they're rebelling.
Well, for any new listeners out there, anytime the word potentate comes up on Symmetry of Soul, you can be guaranteed there's only one thing we're talking about. That's only one context for that word.
Second principle of the Lucifer Manifest.
Foreign.
Yeah. Only those kind of potentates here. Yeah. Throughout the 2 years of their sojourn at Alexandria, Jesus enjoyed good health and continued to grow normally. Aside from a few friends and relatives, no one was told about Jesus as being a child of promise. One of Joseph's relatives revealed this to a few friends in Memphis, descendants of the distant Akhenaten, and they, with a small group of Alexandrian believers, assembled at the palatial home of Joseph's relative benefactor a short time before the return to Palestine to wish the Nazareth family well and to pay their respects to the child. On this occasion, the assembled friends presented Jesus with a complete copy of the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. But this copy of the Jewish sacred writings was not placed in Joseph's hands until both he and Mary had finally declined the invitation of their Memphis and Alexandrian friends to remain in Egypt. These believers insisted that the child of destiny would be able to exert a far greater world influence as a resident of Alexandria than of any designated place in Palestine. These persuasions delayed their departure for Palestine for some time after they received the news of Herod's death.
Okay, so there's some fun little tidbits in here as we're synchronizing things, you know, into recorded history. You know, after Akhenaten, Tutankhamun, you know, went to Memphis, and you're seeing that playing all the way down here to Jesus' time. You know, I think probably you guys are familiar, but maybe some listeners aren't, with, you know, what is that Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures? Well, that is, of course, the Septuagint, you know, which you can still get a copy of today. You know, called Septuagint because of the 70 scholars that translated it, from, you know, the Scriptures from Hebrew to Greek. Which is also validated in the Revelation. You know, so they're getting a copy of the Septuagint, which, you know, we all know kind of plays forward in Nazareth as a very fancy thing for a family to possess. You know, we've got this whole, again, this very not Nazareth-like phenomenon going on here with the fancies of Memphis and Alexandria.
Right.
But we're going to, you know, put that in the rearview mirror, and we're going to go back to Nazareth. You know, just a little between the lines at the very end is a clarification. There's sort of a never-ending scholarly, you know, argument about when did Herod the Great die? Well, you know, it's now, you know, secured here. He did die in 4 BC, not in something else that you might rationalize, you know, as some scholars do. You know, and you can you can see that, yeah, it's probably the April thing too, like it has been deduced. That seems to kind of fit in if they tell you here that they're going to be, heading out, in August, and it was delayed for a while after they received the news. It's like, okay, it seems like it is, definitely there in the springtime of 4 BC that Herod died.
Right. Well, yeah, that's helpful. As I've been reading, getting older and reading, I'm able to piece more of these things together, the difference between Herod the Great and Herod Antipas. Like, I don't know, just I had some childhood allergies to just learning basic world history, but it's enriching the story now. So this is helpful material.
Yeah, we're about to get Antipas and Archelaus here in a second. So
right.
It's important to have a basic sense. Yeah, and again, anyone who's a biblical Christian, you just inescapably have all these things. And then the midwives are again writing to an audience that is familiar with all these things, and so they can just reference those in passing. We're, as a reader, you're expected to know what they're referencing. They're not going to spoon-feed that to you.
Right. Yeah, they didn't say Herod the Great's death there. They didn't. They assume you're a human who can read this paragraph, not a computer program. The computer program would crash because it wouldn't know which Herod you're talking about. So.
Yes.
All right. Real quick before I pass the reading on, the other thought that I had when I some time ago read this paragraph, long ago I heard one of the weaker arguments, atheistic arguments against God's plan and Jesus and all that was, well, if God knew what he was doing, Jesus would have been born in Rome, someplace he could have really exerted an influence. But I mean, boy, they had him born in Bethlehem and grew up in Nazareth. It's probably a very old argument, but it's interesting to see how quickly this argument about, well, only an urban, sophisticated metropolis could be the place that could disseminate, the highest truths of eternity. It couldn't possibly be a more humble and unlearned place. Like, that showed up right here at the beginning of Jesus's life.
Yeah, so you just notice instead of ethics and religion, you have politics and power interpreting that. And you're like, well, obviously, when you're talking about influence, you're talking about political influence, and then God should have had him born in Rome. Like, no,
right.
We're not talking about political influence. So you're thinking that there's not been much influence to the fact that Jesus was born? Last time I checked, definitely the largest religious group on the planet is something called Christians.
Kind of a thing, yeah. All right. David, would you like to take the reading from here?
Yes, sir. Joseph and Mary finally took leave of Alexandria on a boat belonging to their friend Ezrion?
Ezrion.
Bound for Joppa, arriving at the port late in August of the year 4 BC, they went directly to Bethlehem, where they spent the entire month of September in council with their friends and relatives concerning whether they should remain there or return to Nazareth.
Yeah, okay, so, in modern-day Israel, Joppa is southern Tel Aviv there, if people aren't familiar. So they're just going from, the southern coast to the eastern coast there of the Mediterranean, just, cutting across the corner there. And, we've got to deal with, we've dealt with, well, should he stay in Alexandria? Or should he go back to Palestine? Well, okay, we've decided to go to Palestine. It's like, well, should he stay in Bethlehem or should he go back to Nazareth? Then we got to work through that one. Again, we can see here that, we're doing this, around the time of his birthday there in 4 BC.
Yes.
And we'll get to that here shortly. we've got to point out, we've often done this. You know, you're reading along somewhere in the book and you're going, okay, wait a minute. Why do we need to know the name of their friend?
Right. This thing.
Anyone who's been listening for a while, knows that it's like, okay, that's some sort of interesting little tidbit they threw in there. There's apparently some dots you could connect on that one. Okay. If you knew what document to read or,
we know he has a boat. We know that much.
Or what, what was that? Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, we know he owned a boat. We know that much.
Well, yeah, can't we just go to the Alexandria and, check up all the, boat registrations? there was things like libraries getting burned there and stuff. Yeah, probably not. anyway, that's just yet another one of those, like, oh, my goodness, why are they giving you that specific name? I mean, there are times when they don't give you a name, of someone that seems rather significant, and they go, it's like, well, why didn't they just give you that name there? And then there's someone that seems to be completely incidental, like, who owns this boat? And they give you the name. Yeah. And again, there's nothing arbitrary here, right? There's some little agenda there, right? They're giving you some clue there. What is it?
I'm still adjusting from last week's study in 49 to these long paragraphs. It's so stark how long these paragraphs are compared to what we were studying previously.
Yeah, like we always joke, if you don't like long paragraphs, don't pick up a document written by midwares. it's like, take a breath, dude.
Mary had never fully given up the idea that Jesus ought to grow up in Bethlehem, the city of David. Joseph did not really believe that their son was to become a kingly deliverer of Israel. Besides, he knew that he himself was not really a descendant of David, that his being reckoned among the offspring of David was due to the adoption of one of his ancestors into the Davidic line of descent. Mary, of course, thought the city of David the most appropriate place in which the new candidate for David's throne could be reared, but Joseph preferred to take chances with Herod Antipas rather than with his brother Archelaus. He entertained great fears for the child's safety in Bethlehem or in any other city in Judea, and surmised that Archelaus would be more likely to pursue the menacing policies of his father Herod than would Antipas in Galilee. And besides all these reasons, Joseph was outspoken in his preference for Galilee as a better place in which to rear and educate the child. But it required 3 weeks to overcome Mary's objections. Isn't that funny?
Here we are again, Brad.
Place?
Very patient management of the interplay.
I'm sure there were many discussions. Pros and con lists, I'm sure, for the sake of argument, yes, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, Joseph broke out his Excel spreadsheet for her and laid it all out about how it's a better place in which to rear and educate the child, and but again, we have these modern expressions of this, but nonetheless, right? There's an essence of exactly what went on back then, and that fundamental difference between the mindedness of a male and the mindedness of a female, you can notice here, we were just talking about it a second ago, and we were talking about, God should have had him born in Rome. Okay, I mean, you have basically that back and forth. I mean, on the one hand, you see Mary has a bias to politics and power.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Joseph has a bias, ethics and religion. And Joseph needs to win the day. Right? You know, and as we all know, the revelators, you know, the midwives spent a lot of time, you know, clarifying, you know, how it is that Mary has that. I mean, you know, she's not, this is not just Mary. There's this whole complicated thing about Jesus using the kingdom of heaven analogy and how it plays into a long-cherished politics and power-pleasing fable that the Jews have.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, it's playing out right between Joseph and Mary, you know, the same kind of thing that can play out, like you said, today. You know, Jesus was really the Son of God. You know, God would have had him born in Rome.
Well, it's nice. It's nice that in describing that tension between Joseph and Mary regarding this decision, that they show the character in the sense that even though he was outspoken, there were 3 weeks of time in which he allowed Mary the process to sort of have problem solve in a collaborative way.
Mm-hmm. Nicely
he's
worded.
He's not heavy-handed in disregarding her perspective. It's showing both sides of that tension. There's a genuine interplay between them in making these decisions.
Yeah, and it becomes, you know, a mutual.
Yes.
You know, when all is said and done, as they're about to point out, yeah, Joseph convinced her. Okay.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, you know, that whole bit of of going back and forth, not being afraid of dialogue, right? And mm-hmm. And you know, humans are experiential learners, experiential everything.
Right.
And you can only figure out what's right by fundamentally recognizing what's wrong.
Mm. Guilty.
You can't just somehow pull right out of thin air.
Right. The verb here is overcome Mary's objections, not squash her objections, not dismiss her
yeah.
objections, but to work through it. There was probably some very useful discussion and debate and maybe some compromises about the way that they raised their kids back in Nazareth as a result.
Yeah, and they didn't go sideways to resolve it. They went up, over.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They went up.
And it's an example that we could all learn from. We could all aspire.
Right. And there's a potential, very innate potential for husband and wife to overcome because they're, you know, because of their definitive polarity, right, there's a, you know, there's a differential there that produces a, that can produce a super additive consequence.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the, you know, just how vast that difference is just how high the pair can go together to overcome anything.
Mm.
There's not much difference. You know, you have a very small potential. You can get a little bit of, you know, upping word, but not much. But if you have a full differential, right, then there can be a full super additive consequence. You can go above.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get, you know, once they both are looking at it from a common top-down vantage point, it's obvious what's correct. Right. See, so again, the solution wasn't politics and power. The solution was ethics and religion. Right? The religion that gives you potential to have a top-down viewpoint. Let's look at this from above. Oh, Mary says, well, yeah, I see your point.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting how that in the last sentence it says that Joseph was outspoken in his preference for Galilee as a better place. I mean, they could have worded that several different ways, but they specifically chose that word track in which to rear and educate the child. And I mean, it speaks to everything we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, you know, notice he's not a shy violet, okay, in that setting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's being very definitive. Right, and we've got this whole cultural thing. We've talked about this many times in this broadcast. You know, we've all been kind of indoctrinated. Oh, no, that's mean to be definitive. You need to be wishy-washy.
Yeah.
So a nice person is wishy-washy.
Happy
no,
wife
Joseph
is a happy
is not
wife.
Wishy-washy. No. He's a stark, definitive direction. He's not devoid of philosophic sophistication, right? He's not devoid, you know, of a sophistication of presentation of his point, right? But he's not going to compromise, right, on the fundamental principle.
Yeah.
He's going to find a wise way that principle rules the day.
And to me, it points out that, you know, women have just as equal of a right to be outspoken in their preferences of place, you know, once that place is established.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, they need to lay down. It's like, no, we're not literally going to live in a tent our entire lives with 10 kids.
I know that yurt is on sale.
It'd be so much less expensive, dear. Right. Yeah. So, right. I mean, you know, there's a valid foundation, but neither are a complete lifestyle solution, those foundations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You need to go up and encompass the two to get the complete lifestyle solution.
By the 1st of October, Joseph had convinced Mary and all their friends that it was the best for them to return to Nazareth. Accordingly, early in October, 4 BC, they departed from Bethlehem for Nazareth, going by way of Lydda and Scythopolis.
Ah, is the way it's usually pronounced.
Okay. Scythopolis. Can't get it.
Scythopolis.
Scythopolis. They started out early one Sunday morning, Mary and the child riding on their newly acquired beast of burden, while Joseph and five accompanying kinsmen proceeded on foot. Joseph's relatives refused to permit them to make the trip to Nazareth alone. They feared to go to Galilee by Jerusalem and the Jordan Valley, and the western routes were not altogether safe for two lone travelers with a child of tender years.
See, that's the point of Lydda and Scythopolis, right, is that they, they took the western route up, you know, so they kind of, you know, they went, you know, west and then north and then, you know, back east again, you know, instead of kind of going a little bit more straight up.
And it's almost like the association of the family and the friends, they knew that their part was in this role, in this community role, the socialization of the rearing of that child. They knew they had to go. That's awesome. They just picked up, well, they got the young one. We got to go with them.
Yeah, not to mention that, again, you know, they're wisely navigating their environment. And, you know, it's like, well, we have every right to go whatever damn way we want to go. No. It's like, no, okay, that's not wise. And, you know, and if parents are like that, it's like, well, we need to be principled about it. Well, is that the best environment to raise your child in? Well, for one thing, you know, your child may not live very long, you know, in your pig-headed environment.
Yeah.
So, again, you can just, like I said, you can always step back and reflect on every one of these paragraphs as a little vignette on how is this, you know, demonstrating wisdom in raising a child, having a family.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we saw it in the previous one. It's like, well, okay, you got one hand, you got Antipas, the other hand, you got Archelaus. But, you know, no, Antipas, that's a wiser route. Anyway, again, just, you know, rather than saying, well, if we want to live in Judea, the whole world just needs to, you know, see to it that, you know, that's okay. It's like, no, you're not sovereign over the external world.
Right.
It is what it is.
Yes.
And despite all these things, they raised a child that fused, effectively, right, during his life in the flesh. Take note, parents.
Mm-hmm. One, back in Nazareth. On the fourth day of the journey, the party reached its destination in safety. They arrived unannounced at the Nazareth home, which had been occupied for more than 3 years by one of Joseph's married brothers, who was indeed surprised to see them. So quietly had they gone about their business that neither the family of Joseph nor that of Mary knew that they had even left Alexandria. The next day, Joseph's brother moved his family and Mary, for the first time since Jesus' birth, settled down with her little family to enjoy life in their own home. In less than a week, Joseph secured work as a carpenter, and they were supremely happy.
One can just, you know, delight in the fact that they just pulled out all the stops and said supremely happy at the end there.
Those are big words.
Those are strong. That's big stuff, yes, right, as we've talked about many times. But again, you can see that there's happiness because how wisely they've are navigating things, right? I mean, you know, and they feel the pleasure, right, of responding well to negative circumstances. It's not just joy, it's happiness. You know, and it's resonating to the very supreme thread of their created selves.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. They could have taken the negative path. Their life story these last few years could have been very bad. Like, well, these potentates made us register for the census. Jesus wasn't even born in his home, and then we had to go to Alexandria because, you know, this guy wanted to kill him. And I mean, they could have recontextualized everything in a negative way and just gotten stuck and not moved on with their lives. But they interpreted things in an optimistic way, in a godly way, and they kept things moving.
The meaning of life is its adaptability.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Not its pig-headed principledness.
Certainly not its misery. Yeah. Go ahead, Justin.
It just reminds me of this pattern on high, one of the themes we're touching on in this evening's study, on how after these great sort of experiential moments of growth and trial and tribulation, there's always that period of respite, of sort of rejuvenation. And the way that they phrase this with Mary settled down in her little family to enjoy life in their own home, the settling down, there's something about that resting period that's encompassing this difficult journey.
Yeah, and Mary can definitively, right, manifest, you know, the appropriateness of her place instinct. Right?
Yes, yes.
She finally can do her part, you know, fully. You know, let me see to the quality of this place.
And you're happy for him. You see him get there, and all of us can identify. Oh man, yeah, I could visualize that. You know, finally getting into your place, getting the boxes all unpacked. It's a good feeling.
Yeah, just like when the hobbits come back to, you know, the Shire at the end of the movie. It's like, yes, the world's correct again.
Yes, and there's a marriage that happens, and yes, right. And again, you can just, you know, see how they're emphasizing, you know, that God made us, right, the way he did, and if we go with that, you have supreme happiness that results.
Yes.
Amen.
it's almost as if God knows the best way and did it. Don't fight it. Don't be convinced by, you know, silver tongues like Lucifer that there's a better way than God's way. All right. And then this next paragraph here is what I was hinting at. We'll sort some of the details out here after this next paragraph.
Jesus was about 3 years and 2 months old at the time of their return to Nazareth. He had stood all these travels very well and was in excellent health and full of childish glee and excitement at having premises of his own to run about in and to enjoy. But he greatly missed the association of his Alexandrian playmates.
Okay, so this is a very, very useful little foundational paragraph in the Revelation in a certain regard. In regard to the issue of mental development, I wrote a reflection, and put together some reflections on this issue of mental development. You can find that in the Perfecting Horizons Library. I quote this paragraph in there because of its, you know, key role here. In following all the clues and putting it together, how the Revelation is clarifying our mental development. And, they're very definitively validating the concept that humans recognized quite a while back, that there are very distinct mental ages that our development breaks up into. Okay. And they not only have very precise, validations of those precise mental ages throughout the Revelation, as I point out in the mental development paper, but if we step back and look here at this arc that we're about to journey through here in papers 123 through 129, you can see they've completely laid out the entire story based upon those ages. Okay, so the first mental age is up to 3 years old. See, and so this paragraph starts out. Jesus is about 3 years and 2 months old. Okay, they start out by saying, okay, a bit of still being in Bethlehem and doing it being in Alexandria. And then getting back to Nazareth, that spans that first age. And the term they use here for that age is infancy. That's up to 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next age is from 3 up to 8 years old. Okay, that is herein labeled the early childhood. The next one is from 8 up to 12. That is herein labeled the later childhood. The next one, okay, just notice how, when you look at those, when you scan through those papers, like, oh, yeah, it goes from that year to that year. Okay? Yeah, so the next mental age is from 12 up to 16. That's your mindal adolescence. And then the next age is from 16 up to 20. That's your spiritual adolescence. And then from 20 on, that's adulthood. Remember how 20 is the age of choice?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. And see, that's how it's broken up. You know, so not only, you know, various places in the Revelation, you know, I mean, speaking to those Middle Ages, like I said, you know, in very precise fashion. But see, they lay out Jesus' entire life in those ages. Okay. So those are, that's sort of just completely validated, you know, that. You know, what some people today might think of as, well, it was a speculation, I don't know, you know, the more reductionist I get, the more fuzzy it gets. It's like, no, you're befogged by much thinking. It's real. There's these definitive ages. Up to three to eight, you know, up to eight up to 12, 12 up to 16, 16 up to 20. Yeah. And Jesus' entire life is definitively laid out like that.
It's not a one-to-one match of the seven stages that the Jewish people had of that time, but they were on to the basic idea. They probably just didn't have a science, and probably what they had mapped close enough to this to make it work.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, we probably won't get to that here tonight, right, because we're kind of running short on time. But, yeah, as Brad is, everyone, you know, you might remember, Brad is hinting at what comes up in Section 2, right? And so exactly what you're saying, Brad, yeah. It's important to be aware of the science of our mental development. You know, they literally lay out Jesus' life precisely in those blocks. Not an accident. Okay? It's very purposeful. Right? So there's just the layout of the papers into those blocks, right, is a huge statement, you know, for everyone thinking about raising children and what the different phases are.
Here I was thinking I was 44. It turns out I'm somewhere between 16 and 20 still.
I hear you.
Justin, did you want to take over from here?
Sure thing. Thanks, David. On the way to Nazareth, Joseph had persuaded Mary that it would be unwise to spread the word among their Galilean friends and relatives that Jesus was a child of promise. They agreed to refrain from all mention of these matters to anyone, and they were both very faithful in keeping this promise.
You notice the word faithful. We have promises and, you know, sort of precise instructions that we follow. Think of that, you know, use of the word faithful there. You know, it's playing off of, you know, kind of just, you know, the very immediate, you know, sense of faith, of believing God's promises and following his instructions. But again, right? I mean, again, there's, you know, it's unwise. See how much, you know, all these paragraphs, you know, have these elements of wisdom, and that's just constantly playing out. It's also, you know, they keep speaking of it as a child of promise, you know, instead of, say, just maybe child of destiny, kind of a la Gabriel. There's that whole issue, you know, as, again, like we mentioned, about what the Jews think the promise is, right, and the different sects of belief there. You know, so if nothing else, the avoiding talking about him as a child of promise avoids bringing in all of the tensions between the different camps of what the promise is. No, he's our promise. No, he's our promise. And, right? And, you know, they're ripping the child, you know, in half, trying to, you know, possess him for their promise.
Jesus' entire fourth year was a period of normal physical development and of unusual mental activity. Meantime, he had formed a very close attachment for a neighbor boy about his own age named Jacob. Jesus and Jacob were always happy in their play, and they grew up to be great friends and loyal companions.
There's that first favorable condition getting very firmly established, loyal.
Yes.
Sure.
Tadpole Jesus is doing well. And notice the unusual mental activity.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mention one of the things I bring out in that, those reflections on mental development when I talk about that paragraph. But you know, if you think about them mentioning association there, I mean, that's springing in the fifth adjective. You know, that social urge, that you know, mindful energy of socialization. And so you're going, oh, that's probably why there's that dividing line. You know, it's probably, you know, on average, you've got children getting their fifth adjutant at around three years old. That's why there's a line there. See, and so you're kind of completing this, you know, the animal beginning, you know, and then you're going to add the sixth and seventh adjutants on after that, and, you know, roughly age six, okay, you get the seventh. Right. So the unusual comment here
is
Jesus is very precocious. He's going to be moving from getting his fifth adjutant all the way to getting his seventh, yeah, very quickly relative to the, you know, the average.
Yeah, within 1 year.
Okay. That's why they say unusual there. Yeah. It's how quickly you can kind of, you know, bring the fifth, you know, into enough flower to bring in the sixth and, you know, and then in the seventh.
And it's not because he's a creator son incarnate per se. I mean, there are plenty of precocious children who advance, who, you know, develop a little quicker than the average, and that, therefore they're unusual by definition. There's always a bell curve.
Yeah, it's you know, there's that whole selection process. You've got the genetics, you have the nature and the nurture, right? And he's blossoming quickly.
One thought, too, along those lines is how much of this supreme happiness being settled in this place allowed the contexts for him to have that unusual mental accelerated sort of development in this fourth year based upon the stability in contrast to the travel and everything they were going through prior to this.
Right. So like I said, you know, you have to think about both the nature and the nurture.
Yeah. The next important event in the life of this Nazareth family was the birth of the second child, James, in the early morning hours of April 2, 3 BC. Jesus was thrilled by the thought of having a baby brother, and he would stand around by the hour just to observe the baby's early activities.
Ah, Mary was pregnant before they left Alexandria.
Hmm. Uh-huh. One, two, three, I guess.
So,
fair point. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, so just, you know, kind of think about how, you see, they were already, you know, Joseph and Mary decided, yeah, let's get this ball rolling forward here. And, yeah, so she was pregnant before they left.
That's one of the reasons why she was riding on their newly acquired beast of burden. One of many.
But she also took a boat, so I don't know how she handled that. Oh, well. Maybe she didn't.
It was midsummer of this same year that Joseph built a small workshop close to the village spring and near the caravan tarrying lot. After this, he did very little carpenter work by the day. He had as associates two of his brothers and several other mechanics whom he sent out to work while he remained at the shop making yokes and plows and doing other woodwork. He also did some work in leather and with rope and canvas. And Jesus, as he grew up, when not in school, spent his time about equally between helping his mother with home duties and watching his father work at the shop, meanwhile listening to the conversation and gossip of the caravan conductors and passengers from the four corners of the earth.
Ah, the wonderfully balanced environment of nurture. They're obviously, you know, highlighting there. definitive mom influence, definitive dad influence, and then, you know, and then all the others too, cosmopolitan, et cetera.
In July of this year, 1 month before Jesus was 4 years old, an outbreak of malignant intestinal trouble spread all over Nazareth from contact with the caravan travelers. Mary became so alarmed by the danger of Jesus being exposed to this epidemic of disease that she bundled up both her children and fled to the country home of her brother, several miles south of Nazareth, on the Megiddo Road near Sarid. They did not return to Nazareth for more than 2 months. Jesus greatly enjoyed this, his first experience on a farm.
You're going, wait a minute, is that supremacy? Coincidentally, yeah, he got through early on. You know, and we all know how much the revelators point out the importance of getting, you know, these very natural reality groundings.
Yes.
Right.
If you're going to achieve righteousness, you know, you have to have more than just the hunger and thirst, you know, that produces that perfectingness of goodness. Right? You need the other foundational element. You need fact.
Yeah, regarding beauty, there's even that reference when they're talking about the ornate sort of qualities
of
the
cathedral.
Yeah,
but we're not talking about beauty, truth, goodness. We're talking about fact, truth, goodness.
Yeah, I'm just pointing out, being in nature, there's this reference, I don't remember exactly where it's from, where for children in particular, having them be surrounded in nature to acquire that recognition.
Yeah, I mean, there are those higher existential points. But remember, you know, it's not those existential points that get you salvation. It's righteousness.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, it's important to have the fact part. Right, and you know, he's getting, you know, they give you all those details, all those different things his dad did. Look at the diversity of factual grounding there. This is how leather works. This is how rope works. This is how canvas works, yeah, et cetera.
Yeah.
This is how a farm works. This is the difference between a cow and a sheep, and you know, et cetera. Okay.
That's certainly something for us to reflect on. Being parents in this day and age, this highly complex, abstracted day and age, you know, there are plenty of people living now who have never seen a cow alive, you know, because you don't have to.
Yep. So just, again, you can kind of just talk endlessly about all these little vignettes. I mean, it's just how important. There's something important enough to devote a whole paragraph in the Revelation to, okay? There's nothing flippant about any paragraph. Something very consequential about what each paragraph is about.
And when you think of that last statement, Jesus greatly enjoyed this, his first experience on a farm, even in modern times, kind of as Brad's touching upon, we still have these parks and you take kids outside and they love it. It's still baked into the experience at this age of development, being in nature. Yeah.
Well, let's see if we can maybe we have time to do these first two paragraphs, and we can get to the comments about the adjuster arrival.
Yeah, section 2, the fifth year, 2 BC. In something more than a year after the return to Nazareth, the boy Jesus arrived at the age of his first personal and wholehearted moral decision, and there came to abide with him a thought adjuster, a divine gift of the Paradise Father, which had aforetime served with Machaventa Melchizedek, thus gaining the experience of functioning in connection with the incarnation of a supermortal being living in the likeness of mortal flesh. This event occurred on February 11th, 2 BC. Jesus was no more aware of the coming of the divine monitor than are the millions upon millions of other children who before and since that day have likewise received these thought adjusters to indwell their minds and work for the ultimate spiritualization of these minds and the eternal survival of their evolving immortal souls.
Obviously, don't need to point out the survival thing. We've been stressing it all night long, but notice there it is again. And That last point, that he was no more aware of it, okay, I mean, it can be extremely problematic if a child is aware of their adjuster's
right.
arrival.
Right.
It can completely upend their life. I know of that which I speak from people I know. But, you know, other than that, we've talked about that some. You know, not to mention exactly, you know, that first unconscious choice when the personality identifies with your selfhood there. But, you know, let's just take a moment on the, you know, how precocious he is. Okay? You know, remember, you know, that, you know, we have in paper 108, section 2, paragraph 1, right, about the average, you know, just prior to the sixth birthday. You know, and when it says in the present generation is running 5 years, 10 months, and 4 days, that is on the 2,134th day of terrestrial life. Okay, you know, they give that last part about, you know, 2,134, you know, so that you can properly interpret the 5 years, 10 months, 4 days. That's, you know, those months are being defined as 1/12 of a 365-day year.
Mm-hmm.
You can try, you know, calendar means, you can see it doesn't work. You know, and so that's, you know, that's 2,133 days, right, after the day of his birth is what that 5 years, 10 months, 4 days is. For Jesus, again, in my mental development paper, right, I give you the parallel. For Jesus, it's 4 years, 5 months, and 22 days. Okay? And so, you know, you can kind of see, you know, that's kind of setting it how early, you know, it might be relative to the average. You can kind of flip that around and how late it might be relative to the average. You can see that, you know, nearly all humans are going to have their adjusters before they're 8 years old. Right? So
yeah,
it's giving
that's
you,
fair point. Yeah.
See, it's fitting into that, you know, by the end of that second age there, right, the early childhood.
Right.
Everyone's got adjusters now.
Hmm.
On this day in February, the direct and personal supervision of the universe rulers, as it was related to the integrity of the childlike incarnation of Michael, terminated. From that time on, throughout the human unfolding of the incarnation, the guardianship of Jesus was destined to rest in the keeping of this indwelling adjuster and the associated seraphic guardians, supplemented from time to time by the ministry of midway creatures assigned for the performance of certain definite duties in accordance with the instruction of their planetary superiors.
You know, and when all, you know, the bottom line there is, maybe Mary, it wasn't all dependent upon Mary being very mother-like.
Right.
Yeah. Skin knees, yes, but okay, yeah. There is a
also,
little bit of...
Yeah. A yeah. host of angels, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Excellent start to this arc. It's already got my mind brimming with ideas. And before I say goodnight to everyone, just as a reminder, later this week, Symmetry of Soul will be unveiling a new 25-minute or so podcast. Check symmetryofsoul.org, our homepage, for details on how to find that. It's not going to affect this Tuesday evening broadcast. This continues, as always. The new one will be on Podbean, another podcasting website. So check our website for more details. Hope to see you there. Until then, follow the way.
Take care, everyone.
God bless.
Yep.
Good night.
Yep. Bye now, everyone.